Good Saturday morning to you, and welcome to another hour of the Conservative Thought Hour. We're so glad you're here. We're here to educate you with wonderful guests, enlightening guests, and hopefully you will learn as we do the whole hour. It's Carrie Black with you, along with political activist Rick Stannard. And our guest today, Dr. Patrick Moore, an internationally renowned ecologist and environmentalist, beginning his career as an activist and leader in the Greenpeace movement. He now concentrates his efforts on collaborative aimed at finding environmental solutions. He speaks and lectures frequently at universities, community meetings, and conferences as well. As a public figure and a senior spokesperson for the Forest Alliance of BC, he appears on national television and radio, hello, and is often quoted in the press. As Director and Vice President, Environment and Government Affairs for Water Furnace International from 1995 to 1998, he also worked to build awareness of the benefits of renewable earth energy technology. He's also an accomplished author and photographer and recently published Green Spirit: Trees Are the Answer. I love that. A book on forestry and the environment. Dr. Moore believes strongly in the multi-stakeholder, consensus-based approach to resolving conflicts involving environmental, social, and economic issues. Also in 1991, Dr. Moore founded Green Spirit, a consultancy focusing on environmental policy and communications in natural resources, biodiversity, energy, and climate change. Rick, I know this is one you've been looking forward to for a long time.
Absolutely. We have been watching the arguments being presented by Al Gore and his fans, and we don't believe them. Carrie?
Yeah.
We've got to start again.
Oh, okay.
There's an enormous echo.
Okay. Is that
yeah,
any better?
I tend to agree. I think maybe my phone automatically phoned on Wi-Fi, but I don't know if this is a problem at my end because I hear the same thing.
Okay, is that any
from
better?
You, Rick?
Carrie, have you can you move your
yeah
your the proximity of your mic and speaker?
Absolutely. Let me know if that's any better.
Testing 1, 2, 3. Sounds better to me. How about you, Patrick?
Yes, it does sound better. How am I?
Yep, perfect. All
yep.
Right, you guys go ahead and start, Rick, and I'll just edit that all out. No problem.
All right. Patrick, to start, you used to sit on the board of Greenpeace International, and in fact, you're one of the founders of Greenpeace. Can you tell us why that relationship ended?
Well, it was 15 years of very important work, I believe. We started out in the early 70s at the height of the Cold War and the Vietnam War and the threat of nuclear war. And it was a group of people combining the concern for civilization's destruction by nuclear war, and that was the peace part of Greenpeace, and the environment, which was a fairly new consciousness, the emerging consciousness of the environment. And we created Greenpeace as a way of bringing those two things together and tackled hydrogen bomb testing, nuclear testing in the atmosphere by France, and made a couple of really big victories early on in the early 70s. Our actions helped to cause President Nixon to cancel the hydrogen bomb testing that was going on in Alaska underground. And our actions of sailing a boat into the test zone in the South Pacific where France was detonating atmospheric nuclear weapons brought an end to that as well. And so by 1975, we had kind of chalked up two really large victories on this front. And by this time, the United States and Russia were entering into talks to reduce the number of nuclear missiles. And the Cold War, which was actually pretty close to a hot war, cooled off. And so we turned our attention to the fact that 30,000 big whales were still being slaughtered each year in the North Pacific by Russian and Japanese factory whaling fleets. And we sailed out there and got in front of the harpoons and got that all around the world, people saw us trying to protect those whales from the harpoons by getting in front of the boats with our little rubber rafts. And this just made us famous worldwide. And we went on then, after we had spent 5 years on voyages against the whaling fleets, they finally decided to ban deep sea whaling in the North Pacific and eventually in all the world's oceans. We moved on to toxics, and this is where it turned difficult for me. I had helped negotiate the founding of Greenpeace International in 1979 and had become one of the five directors of it. But I was the only one with any formal science education. And in addition, the environmental movement had kind of changed, and the peace kind of got dropped off the green. And now the environmentalists that I was working with were beginning to describe the human species as the enemy of nature, the enemy of the earth. And I just found that unacceptable. It's too much like original sin for me. And to basically take the position that humans are the only evil species out of the 1.7 odd million species we have identified in this world just didn't sit right. I believe that we're all one evolutionary chain. We came from life just like all the other living creatures on the earth did. We're a little bit different than most of them, but then some of them are a lot of different from each other too. And so I couldn't take that at the philosophical level. And then my fellow directors, again, none of whom had any science education, decided we should take on a campaign to ban chlorine worldwide. And I said, hey, you guys, chlorine is one of the elements, one of the 94 natural elements in the periodic table, one of the building blocks of the universe. And not only that, adding chlorine to drinking water and to swimming pools and hot tubs and spas was the biggest advance in the history of public health, preventing the spread of waterborne diseases. And indeed, about 80% of our pharmaceuticals are based on chlorine chemistry, and some 15 to 20% of them actually have chlorine in them. And then I mentioned table salt, sodium chloride, which is an essential nutrient for all life. So all life has chlorine in it. So maybe you should take a bit more a nuanced approach to chlorine. Maybe there's some chlorinated chemicals that should be controlled strictly. I agree with that, but not all chlorinated compounds need to be controlled strictly, like table salt, for example. And but they decided to go ahead anyways, and that was just too much for me. That was the straw that broke the camel's back right there.
So and you're I telling had to me leave. That they poured salt in your wound?
That would be a very good way of putting it, Rick. I never thought of that one before, but yes. The wound was the position that the people are the enemy of the earth, and the salt was the essential nutrient that we all need to survive.
Patrick, we in the field, common laymen, non-scientists, are inundated with stories in the media, in newspapers, and magazines, and on television, that are, I call them ghost stories, where people try and scare the living daylights out of us for the intent of forcing a change in our economy. Now, there was one that was a headline article in the Detroit News last week. And I'd like to read to you just a couple of passages and get your comments as a scientist on what your thoughts are in regards to the way the story was written and what the writer was trying to accomplish. The first statement is this, quote, "While conducting research in Greenland, ice scientist Twyla Moon was struck this summer by what climate change has doomed Earth to lose and what could still be saved." That's a pretty scary sentence What are your thoughts?
Well, doomsday is the flavor of the month. I mean, they're telling us there's about 50 different things that are going to be doomed. And one of them is the ice in the Arctic, apparently. Now, a lot of people don't know that most of life, there's been no ice in the Arctic through most of the history of life, which is about 3.5 billion years. And indeed, before this Pleistocene ice age set on 2.6 million years ago, which is still here, we can tell because there's large ice caps on both poles. But the North Pole, for example, didn't start to freeze over until about 3 million years ago. For 250 million years before that, it was warmer on this Earth, and there was no ice on the poles, because that's when that previous ice age, named the Karoo, ended, and it lasted for 100 million years. This one is only 2.6 million years old. We don't know how long this ice age is going to last. But because we're in an interglacial period now, one of at least 40, which have appeared after each of the major glaciations that have occurred in cycles through the 2.6 million year Pleistocene ice age, people think this is normal and that any amount of warmth beyond this would be detrimental. When in fact, if it gets warmer, the Earth will get greener, especially given the fact that we are putting some CO2 back into the atmosphere, which was severely reduced over the period of life. The carbon in the atmosphere, in the form of carbon dioxide and in the sea, has constantly reduced for the last 150 million years. And it's a big story as to why, but that's the truth. So contrary to the idea that it is getting too hot and there is not enough, and that there's too much CO2. The truth is, this is a cold period in Earth's history. Life has gone through tens of millions of years of much warmer climate than we have today. And carbon dioxide was virtually always higher, much higher than it is today in the deep past. Not that deep, actually. If you go back 3-5 million years, and it was higher than it is now, when we started putting some CO2 back. That's the key thing to recognize, that all the carbon dioxide we're putting into the atmosphere, which some of which also dissolves into the oceans, was taken out of the atmosphere originally by plants in using photosynthesis to make sugars out of CO2 and water. And that's why the CO2 has continued to go down, because those elements have been lost into sediments. People don't realize that all the sediments in the bottom of the sea and those on the land that used to be the bottom of the sea, like the prairies, for example, the Great Plains, that used to be a sea bottom. All of that is full of sediments, much of which is carbon, especially the fossil fuels. All the fossil fuels are made from CO2. By plants in the first place, and locked in the ground, thus reducing the amount of CO2 that's in the atmosphere. So the whole thing, the whole narrative, as they like to call it, the story, and I love the way you call it a ghost story, because that sums up the thesis of my latest book, titled Fake Invisible Catastrophes and Threats of Doom.
Which I've read, incidentally.
Well, Rick, isn't it interesting that all these scare stories are based on things that are either invisible, like carbon dioxide, radiation, and whatever bad thing is supposed to be in GMOs, which actually doesn't exist, because if it did, it would have a name and a chemical formula, because everything does. Everything that exists does, and they don't seem to have a name for the bad thing in GMOs. Invisible or very remote, like coral reefs and polar bears, so that the average person can't see for themselves what the truth is about the stories that are being told. And just like with ghosts, they're often invisible. And so you can make up a ghost story, and sometimes people will believe it, even though they've never actually seen the ghost. And nobody has seen CO2 because it's invisible, and nobody sees the radiation that they're all worried about because it's invisible. And then you've got the coral reefs, which are both more or less invisible and very remote in far-flung tropical areas. And so that's how these stories are made. So at a practical level, what happens is the politicians and the bureaucrats need stories to scare the people, to make them afraid so they can be more easily controlled. They pay the scientists to give them those stories. And they won't give the scientists money unless they give them a story that's useful for them. It's not like as if this is General Motors or DuPont or 3M doing this science. They do science in practical ways to make better products.
Well,
but when the government pays for science, it's political. And so the government pays for the scientists to give them the story, and then the politicians promise the electorate through the media and the activists that they're going to do something about this to save them from certain destruction and death, and their grandchildren too. And that's how they gain power.
Well, Patrick, tell us again the name of your book, and is it available on Amazon or at bookstores?
Rick, it's Fake Invisible Catastrophes and Threats of Doom, because a lot of this is about the future, that they say if we keep doing what we're doing now, there will be a doomsday or an apocalypse or an end time. And this has been going on through the centuries. There's always been people standing on a street corner with a sign saying the end is near. And this is what we're dealing with here. And for some reason, society has never caught on to recognizing that all the doomsday scare stories of the past did not come true. None of them. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. So these guys are batting zero on the doomsday scenario. And yet, people still fall for it. And they're falling for it every day, whether it's about polar bears or coral reefs or CO2 causing the earth to get too hot for life or all these scenarios. They're willing, for some reason, to believe that the earth is coming to an end soon. And that makes them afraid and easy pickings for power-tripping people who want to control them. And the COVID is another good example of that, the draconian measures that have been brought in there. They've made us afraid of a disease that hasn't killed 0.5% of the people. Compared to past pandemics, this is not anything unusual. As a matter of fact, it's mild compared to the Spanish flu or the Black Death. And you go back in history, there's been some real doozers where nearly half the population was killed at times. So we're being basically propagandized into being afraid. And unless you really understand these issues clearly, and for some reason, a lot of people are willing to take the word of people whose purpose is to make them afraid. And now the media in North America and Europe has just been completely corrupted by the same sort of thing, the scare stories and the demonization of certain classes of people and all this stuff. I mean, what's going on right now is really quite incredible. And I say we're living in an age of scientific and medical ignorance at this time.
Well, I'm reading something in that article in the Detroit News, and there's a quote from the former NASA chief scientist. Now, this is somebody who looks like he has credentials. His name is Waleed Abdulati, and he now runs the University of Colorado's environmental program. And he says, according to the author, if we end up in a seasonally sea ice-free Arctic in the summertime, that's something human civilization has never known. That I can understand. But then he turns around and says, that's like taking a sledgehammer to the climate system. Is it?
No, well, as I said, the Arctic was ice-free, never mind in the summer, but all year around for over 150, 200 million years before it froze here. And it just happens that humans evolved into an ice age. That's just the way it is. I mean, 2.6 million years ago, you could maybe say there were proto-hominids, but it wasn't really, modern people. But we evolved rather rapidly. And maybe one of the reasons we did was because the climate changed rather rapidly coming into this Pleistocene Ice Age. But we are a tropical species. One of the most interesting things about humans is that because they learned to make fire, to control fire, and use the skins of other species for warmth, and build structures to live in. So fire, shelter, and clothing are the only reason that humans were able to come out of Africa from the equatorial region, because we are a tropical species. We are not an Arctic species. We are not a subarctic species. We are not a subtropical species. We are out and out a tropical species. And if we were just a, you know, like other animals are, without fire, shelter, or clothing, well, many animals have learned and evolved to be in northern climates, digging hole in the ground all winter to hibernate to get away from the cold, or they wouldn't survive. So they have figured out how to build a shelter by hibernating. But they don't, and they generally have very thick fur, and they don't have fire, which we're lucky enough to have. But so the human species has been able to spread around the earth much more than in much larger range than most species because of food, because of clothing and shelter and fire. And that's a simple fact. But we are not an ice age species in the sense of what people are talking about, that if the ice on the North Pole disappeared, it would be a problem for people. It wouldn't. We'd be able to move further north and farm further north. Every degree Celsius that the climate warms lets us go 200 kilometers further north in Canada and Russia, which is a huge amount of land, because in the northern hemisphere, as you know, the land occupies more area than the ocean, unlike the southern hemisphere, where it's almost all ocean. So the Antarctic froze up sooner than the Arctic did going into this ice age.
Well, we had an interview last week with Greg Wrightstone, who I think you know.
And I do.
He made a very interesting comment. He said studies have shown that 20 times more humans die because of cold weather than warm weather. So that shows to go you that you're
absolutely
right.
Yes, it's a fact, because we are accustomed to warm weather. I mean, we're okay at 30 degrees Celsius or 90, whatever it is, Fahrenheit. It's only when it gets above 100, 110 that we need to be in the shade for sure, and we'd rather be swimming in the water at that point. But we don't have to do that because we have air conditioning, and you've got 5 million people living in Phoenix. That's because of the technology we have that we're able to do that. And for some reason, the modern environmental movement has gone off on a tangent where they would like to get rid of most of the things that keep us alive every day, which the main one of which is fossil fuels. And like 80% of our energy is from fossil fuels. On the other hand, they're opposed to hydroelectric dams and they're opposed to nuclear energy, the other two main technologies other than fossil fuels that can provide 24/7 power reliably. Instead, we got this fantasy that wind and solar is going to run the world, which is a total fantasy. It's just not going to happen. And yet they're driving it in that direction and causing electricity prices. Like Germany is three times what the electricity price in the United States is. Well, as you may know, Germany has adopted this policy of maximizing renewable, as they call it, energy. You know, it really isn't right to call it renewable in a way, because all of the technology is made with non-renewable materials like concrete and steel and aluminum and et cetera, fiberglass. The machines themselves, the wind farms and the solar farms, are not renewable. They have to be replaced when they wear out. And unfortunately, they wear out within 20 years, they need to be replaced, whereas a gas plant will last 40 years, a coal plant will last 60 years, a nuclear plant will last 80 years and more. So it's very important how long these things can continue to operate, because the cost of them is doubled if they only good for half the time.
Well, we have 55,000 inoperative wind turbines just in the United States at this time.
Well, that's interesting. One of my slogans is "May they rest in place," and take off on rest in peace, because they do not last that long. And the main point, though, is they only provide energy about a third of the time at best in some cases. Solar obviously doesn't work at night, but it also doesn't do much in the early morning or the late afternoon, because the sun is low and the energy isn't there. And then when it's cloudy. So that's really compromised. And wind, of course, is really unpredictable. At least you can predict when the sun's going to be up. But you can't always predict when the clouds are going to come over the sun, although we're pretty good at that now. But you when the wind goes away and the sun goes away, you have to have something to back them up. And usually the backup technology is more reliable than the wind and solar, which is they're trying to make it the primary technology. You always want your primary technology to be the most reliable one. And in the case of natural gas and coal and nuclear and hydroelectric, those are reliable. And they're not all fossil fuel, just two of them. The other two, hydroelectric and nuclear, are not fossil fuel. And yet the people who are against fossil fuels are also against nuclear and hydro, the two technologies that could actually replace a lot of fossil fuels, especially nuclear. Hydro is limited because the sites for hydroelectric are limited by geography, by topography, and by rainfall, of course. You're not going to have too many hydroelectric plants in Saudi Arabia where it's flat and dry. Denmark's the same. It's not dry, but it's flat. And so we've got nuclear as a technology that can be deployed anywhere in the world. The Chinese have just announced a 115 nuclear plant build over the next 10 years. They get it. They understand the future. That fossil fuels will eventually run out, and a really good strategy would be to replace them with nuclear energy wherever you can so that they will last longer. Because air traffic, for example, there's no other alternative we know of to run airplanes with besides fossil fuels. And the same goes for heavy trucks and much heavy transport, heavy farm equipment. We don't have the technology to run those things on batteries. And we also don't have the ability to charge that many batteries. You have to increase the electricity. And increasing the electricity means you have to have reliable energy, and wind and solar aren't. So they are, you know, dead in the water right at the start. And yet they're pouring billions of dollars into it, and they're subsidizing it to the hilt with tax credits and write-offs and subsidies and mandates that require utilities to buy a certain amount of wind and solar energy, no matter how much it costs. And that is why in Germany now, electricity is three times the price it is in North America. And it's probably more than three times the price it is in China, because they're doing very well, but they're not as wealthy as a nation. Of the 1.6 billion of them are not as wealthy as North Americans and Western Europeans. So they can't afford the same kind of luxuries. But if we go the way that the so-called green movement is telling us to go these days, and I think it went off the rails when I left it over 30 years ago, 35 years ago, it had already put fundraising ahead of practicality, ahead of feasibility, and just started making up stories about what you know the world was going to come to an end from climate change if we didn't build wind and solar. And that's not going to fix it. Where do they think the materials for building the wind and solar come from? They come from mines with huge equipment digging in the ground to get the steel and the concrete to build these things, and the glass and the minerals that are in the solar panels. And China's, I'm sure, just laughing all the way to the bank at the way North America and Europe are behaving
Well, they sure didn't show up in Glasgow, did they?
No, they didn't. They know we're cutting our own throats, and that's going to be good for them to ascend not only in economic but military power. And I don't know. You know, people talk about global government. I know what that means. Bureaucrats in Beijing controlling the world. And I don't want a world like that. I want to remain in a democratic system. But even our democratic system, as you know, I'm Canadian, and I'm living in a similar situation now to the United States. Well, it's a bit different. Your leader is demented. Our leader is just plain dumb and not educated. And I don't know how we're going to get out of this mess. I hope it happens soon. We're being led down a garden path that is going to be very destructive of our society and our economy at this point. But I'll stick to the main specialty of mine, which is the environmental side and climate change.
Well, let's talk for a second about carbon.
Okay. Yes, carbon.
Because that's boogeyman that all of the Al Gore and his kinds of people want to shove down our throat. They, you know, we are currently at somewhere around 410 parts per million now of CO2. Where should that number be? I always ask scientists this, and nobody's ever given me an answer. What do you think the
answer
is?
That's because there is no definitive answer. But if we want life to exist at all, it has to be over 150. And during the most recent glaciation, which peaked 20,000 years ago, it dropped down to 180, which is only 50 ppm above the death of plants, which would be basically the death of life. And so this happened for the first time that it got that low. It was never lower in the history of the Earth than it was 20,000 years ago. Coming out of the glaciation, the CO2 goes up because when the oceans warm, they give off gases, one of which is CO2. So the reason that the CO2 went from 180 to 280 into the interglacial period was due to the warming of the seas. We know that is a fact. It didn't get warmer because of CO2. It was the warming of the oceans by the glacial cycles which caused the CO2 to increase in the atmosphere coming out of the oceans. So we are now at 410, 420, I think, pretty near. And that is still very low in terms of what plants would prefer. There's a really good reason why greenhouse operators, commercial greenhouse operators, growing food and flowers and such, inject CO2 into their greenhouses to make it somewhere between 800 and 1,200 parts per million. In other words, 2 to 3 times what it is in the atmosphere now, which gives them up to 60% additional yield. Because right now, even at 420 parts per million, virtually every plant that's living outdoors in this world is starving for CO2. CO2 that we've put in the atmosphere, bringing it from 280 up to 420 now, has resulted in a huge increase in growth of trees, food crops, and green plants in general around the Earth. It's called the greening of the Earth. NASA recognizes it in their literature. The Australian top science organization, CSIRO, was the one who broke this news in, I think it was 2014, that the greening of the Earth is real. And the reason it's happening is because we're putting the CO2 back into the atmosphere that was taken out and lost into the sediments over the millions and millions of years of the past. So one of the ways carbon or CO2 is lost to the atmosphere is by the marine calcifying species. This is the coral reefs, the clams, the mussels, the oysters, the small organisms, the plankton in the sea, which make shells for themselves. It's about protective armor. And plants in the sea learned how to make protective armor, and then animals in the sea learned how to make protective armor for themselves out of calcium carbonate. And the carbon in the carbonate came from CO2 in the ocean. So when those shells fall to the bottom of the ocean and make limestone, they take the carbon out of the ocean, and then more carbon has to come from the atmosphere to keep the balance between the atmosphere and the ocean. There's an equilibrium of carbon dioxide between, a chemical equilibrium between the atmosphere and the ocean. So the optimum level of CO2 from the plant's perspective, which is what gives all of life the ability to be here, is photosynthesis in plants. Otherwise, animals couldn't be here because they don't make their own energy. Whereas through sunlight, plants do. They make glucose from CO2 and H2O, water, and that is the basis of the energy for all of the life on Earth, right up through us. And so 2,000 ppm would be really a good level for CO2. 1,000 is fine, 800 is okay. But 800 is kind of a minimum if you're looking for maximum growth. But CO2 has been as high as 10,000 and maybe more. We don't know enough about it in the past before half a billion years ago because we don't have the life, the fossils, and the sedimentary history to understand. Because, you know, up until about 550 so many years ago, for the first 3 billion years of life, it was all microscopic, single cell, and confined to the ocean. So it was like a bunch of bacteria swimming around in the ocean, basically. Photosynthesis evolved way before that, and then sexual reproduction evolved. But they were still all just microscopic life forms in the sea. There was no life on the land. And so it's only since modern life emerged in what was called the Cambrian explosion in the Cambrian period, which began about 540 million years ago. And was, I don't know if it was 100 million years in length, something like that. Modern life emerged, which is multicellular life, large life. That's the first time there was anything more than a single cell life form. So we need people to at least go into Wikipedia or somewhere and read about the history of the Earth's life and about the history of the Earth's atmosphere and the temperature and all that. And if they do, they will see that this is a tempest in a teapot that these people are harping about now. There's nothing unusual happening to the Earth right now, except that it's colder than it usually has been, and CO2 became really low, and we helped fix that inadvertently. We were burning fossil fuels for energy, not because we thought we needed to put more CO2 in the atmosphere, but now we know that. We are enhancing life on the Earth by putting CO2 into the atmosphere. So they've got it backwards on virtually every count. And, you know, I just learned this from my mentor, William Happer, who is the chairman of the CO2 Coalition. He's a professor emeritus in atmospheric physics and invented a laser beam. I mean, he's an amazing person. And he just knows so much science. And he told me this: if there wasn't CO2 in the ocean to buffer the alkaline effect of the calcium and potassium and sodium, etc., the pH of the oceans would be 11.3. which is the same as Drano. In other words, not only is CO2 in the oceans necessary for life as a food source, it also makes the oceans suitable for life at pH 8, 7.5 to 8.5. It is a buffering reaction. So acid and base is something that's not that hard to understand. The oceans will never become actually acidic. It's impossible for that to happen. Yet they talk about ocean acidification because acid sounds dangerous as opposed to basic or alkaline. Alkaline actually is very dangerous, especially at pH 11.3, where it'll, you know, burn the skin off you, just like acid will if it's at pH 2. So just the most basic science is needed to understand many of these things, Rick.
Well, Is a CO2 level of 1,000 or 2,000 dangerous to human beings?
Well, let's look at it this way. Every time we exhale, breathe out, there's 40,000 ppm CO2 that has been in our lungs and is being exhaled. And then we breathe in oxygen and air that has a very low level of CO2 in it. The oxygen goes into our blood where it is turned into carbon dioxide. And that comes back to our lungs, and we breathe it out at between 40 and 50,000 ppm. That isn't hurting us, and we're doing it all day, 24 hours a day. We have 40,000 ppm in our lungs every time we breathe out. So the Apollo 13 astronauts who had an a CO2 problem, it went up to at least 20,000, and they were fine when they fixed that. You can't let it go. Like 100,000 would be bad, because it basically then becomes an asphyxiation, sort of like drowning. Like, water isn't toxic, but you can drown from it because it prevents the oxygen from going into your lungs. That's what asphyxiation is. Can't breathe properly. And CO2 can get up to levels where you can't breathe properly. But that's never going to happen. We've only got it up to 420. Submariners have a limit of 8,000, and they go underwater for 3 months. So that's the kind of numbers people need to understand. And in the greenhouse, in commercial greenhouses, people are in there working all day long at 800 to 1200 ppm, two and three times what it is now. So the CO2 is not a health issue. CO2 is the basis for all life on Earth. The carbon in CO2 is the carbon in all life on Earth. So we need to think about it just a little bit differently, instead of thinking it's some kind of toxic poison, which the EPA has said it is, that it's an air pollutant, and that it's going to cause the world to fry. Not true.
Not true. Our current government is trying to get us off of fossil fuels. So if they could push a button and end all fossil fuels tomorrow, they would do so. What would happen if we stopped burning fossil fuels tomorrow?
People would begin to die by the droves, especially people, say, for example, who live on the 30th floor of a condo in a city of 5 million people, and they're facing north. So they're not going to be able to grow food on their balcony. And they depend, while they're sleeping, on big trucks coming in from the farms, where big tractors and big combines run by fossil fuels are responsible for stocking the shelves in the supermarket. I'm not sure if the people living on the 30th floor actually know where the food comes from that's on their shelves. It just turns up every night. But that would stop happening if we stopped using fossil fuels. And so many other things would stop happening if we stopped using fossil fuels. This idea
that we heat our houses
electric. Pardon me?
How would we heat our houses? I mean, Vancouver, where you're from, would be in trouble without some fossil fuels.
Well, just about everywhere in the world would be, but especially where it's too cold not to have heat in your house. What another thing I say is, it would only be a few years till there wasn't a tree left on the planet, because the main source of energy would then become wood. And in fact, wood is still a bigger source of energy than all the wind and solar combined in the world. It's called biomass. And the wind and solar people are against it too, because they say we shouldn't be burning things. These people are basically against fire. And fire was a foundation of the beginning of human civilization. Cooking your food and heating your cave. That was the basis of human civilization a long time ago. And now they're saying we shouldn't burn anything. They're against the use of waste to make energy, for example. Whereas in Western Europe, countries like France and Germany do not have any landfills anymore. They either recycle, which is about 50% of the waste, municipal waste, the combustible waste. I mean, it's easy to recycle glass and metal. That's a no-brainer. But the combustible stuff, which is mainly composed of paper, plastic, and wood, like wood from the demolition of buildings, for example, you got short pieces of wood full of nails. You're not going to recycle that. So they build waste-to-energy plants. There's actually one in Minneapolis, St. Paul, at the airport there, it advertises that when you put your combustible waste in a bin, it's going to be making electricity. There's one on Long Island. There's quite a few, but there's not that many in the U.S. So the U.S. and Canada both put 50% or more of their municipal waste in landfills. In other words, they dump it and do nothing useful with it. Whereas in Europe, 4% of all of Europe's electricity is from waste to energy plants. And then another big percentage is from biomass, which is waste wood in the forest, for example. And, you know, that's also a huge potential energy source. And, well, it's actually a huge energy source, period, because there's quite a lot of energy being used from trees. And there's still a lot of trees. As a matter of fact, the world's forests have grown in extent in the last 100 years. Even the U.S. forests are larger now in area than they were 100 years ago, and so are Canada's, because our agriculture has become so much more efficient that we can grow five times as much food on the same area of land. And in 1900, 25% of all the farmland was dedicated to feeding draft animals, because they didn't have motorized tractors and all the rest. So the way things have changed during the modern era of human civilization has actually resulted in more forests. China and India, the same. The last 30 years, they've added millions of acres of new forest in those countries and greened the earth. So, like, only about 2-3% of the world is covered in cities. You go up in an airplane. Sometimes I think people who fly in planes never look out the window, or maybe shut it so they can't see. I mean, if you go up in an airplane, you can see how much nature there still is in this world. It's phenomenal. And yet they pretend that it's all gone and all turned into concrete.
Well, concrete's a big holder of carbon, isn't it?
Yes, it is, because it's made with, it's not a holder of carbon, it's an emitter of carbon, in that the limestone that's used to make cement is calcium carbonate, which was created by the shells of species in the ocean. And that calcium carbonate is turned into lime, calcium oxide, which gives off CO2, thus also putting some CO2 back into the atmosphere that was originally taken out by light. It's a great paradox that life itself, by using carbon dioxide and losing a lot of it to the sediment rather than putting it back in the atmosphere after they finished with it, predicted the death of life. Life was killing itself by pulling the CO2 out of the atmosphere, and one species has come along in evolution, and inadvertently, like, it was inadvertent that making shells was going to cause the CO2 to go down too low. It's also inadvertent that human beings using fossil fuels and limestone is causing the CO2 to go back up again. We have restored a balance to the global carbon cycle. There's no doubt about it.
I hate to break in here, Patrick, but we have reached the end of our hour.
Well, hallelujah.
And for me, that's very sad, because I want to go on and on and on.
Well, we can always do another one, Rick. I'm here anytime you want me.
Fabulous. I really appreciate it. For everyone, this is Patrick Moore, and you should read his book or go to www.ecosense.me, because that's his
and
website.
It is on every Amazon site, Fake Invisible Catastrophes and Threats of Doom.
Fabulous. Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you, Rick. Very nice talking to you.